Hello, friends, and welcome back to the Johncast. My name is John Jorgensen, and we're doing some summer reading, folks. Just like when you were a little kid in school, and your teacher would give you a summer reading list. Actually, I hope it's not anything like that, because if you're like me, I ignored that summer reading list and did none of it. And I hope we are actually reading the Gospels, and I hope that these lessons that we've been going through have been helping you dive a little bit deeper into those texts. Before we start today's lesson, I want to just take a moment to bring us up to speed, because we have covered a lot, and our first lesson was about 6 weeks ago at this point, and so it might be helpful for us to do a little bit of a review, a little bit of a reminder. So, to bring us up to speed, thus far, we have talked about how to read the Gospels well and how to read them wisely. Specifically, we have looked at the theological, the historical, and the virtue-forming nature of the Gospels, the four Gospels that start off the New Testament. And we looked at that theological message, the way the Gospels do history, and then the purpose of the Gospels, which is for not just information, but transformation. We looked at those three things as the main three ingredients in this Gospel cake. We've been talking about reading the Gospels is a lot like baking a cake. There's a ton of ingredients that you need to use, and some ingredients, you have to use them more than others. Some ingredients are a little perhaps less important, and even if you leave certain ingredients out, you can still make a pretty good cake. But in order for us to get the full richness of these gospel accounts, we need to understand each individual ingredient. And our first three main ones were the theological, historical, and virtue-forming nature and messages of the Gospels. Then in week four, we looked at the cultural context of first century Palestine, the time where Jesus lived, and then, of course, the time in which many of these accounts were written. And then last week, we dove in a little bit into the relationship between the Gospels and the Old Testament, how the authors of these accounts rely heavily on texts from the Old Testament and sort of draw on an encyclopedia of knowledge that their original audiences would have had. And if we are the Bible nerds that we are seeking to be, we will read the Old Testament and begin to cultivate that same encyclopedia of knowledge. And when we have that, it will lead us into a deeper engagement and understanding of these accounts. So that's kind of where we've been. And today we are arriving at perhaps one of the most obvious questions that people ask when they run into the Gospels. And that is the question, why four? Why are there four Gospel accounts? Like, is it necessary to have four accounts of Jesus's life? I mean, aren't all four of them telling the exact same story? And why do some stories appear in one of the accounts, but not in another? Or why does a certain story happen in a different way or at a different place in one account than it does in another? I mean, don't these contradictions work against Christianity's claim that the Bible is true? If you have spent more than 10 seconds reading or thinking about the Gospels, these questions have likely come up for you. And I want you to know that is totally natural, and that's okay. These are questions that I have wrestled with, and these are questions that Christians have been wrestling with since the beginning. I mean, as early as the second century, there was a scholar named Titian who put together something called a Diatessaron. And this was the first that we know of attempt to combine all four Gospels into a single coherent narrative of Jesus's life. And there are plenty of other resources that have been put together since the second century that are trying to do that, that are trying to put together or piece together all four of these different accounts into one cohesive account. Lately, though, this approach of sort of smoothing out the rough edges, as it were, has gone out of style, specifically with theologians like Richard Burridge, who says proper study and use of historical research will lead to a better understanding than an uncritical blending which smooths out the distinctive picture of each gospel. In his book, Four Gospels, One Jesus, which is a great read. I highly recommend it. Burridge makes this claim that each gospel author is presenting a different portrait or a different angle of Jesus. And therefore, each author will shape their unique narrative in order to make that point. We introduced this a few weeks ago by talking about how the gospel authors do history. They're presenting the facts of history, but they are shaping it and telling the story in such a way to make their own unique point. And Burridge, in his book, is making the claim that not only are the four Gospels doing that collectively, but each individual author is highlighting different aspects of who Jesus is and his character. So to give you an example of this, if someone were to want to tell the story of my life, for some reason, not sure why they would want to do that, but if someone wanted to tell the story of my life and they wanted to do it simply by using one picture, they might choose a picture of me preaching on stage at a church. But they also might choose a picture of me with Sweet Bear and Buckets and my family. But they also might choose a picture of me running a distance race, or even a picture of me cheering on the Chicago Bulls. Now, all of these different pictures, they're all pictures of me. All of them are true to who I am. But each one of them highlights a different aspect of my character or my personality or my calling in the world. Yes, cheering for the Bulls, it is part of my calling, and lately it has been a heavy burden to bear. But anyway, this is partly what's happening in the four different gospel accounts, yes? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are all telling the story of Jesus, but they are each choosing to highlight different aspects of who Jesus is in order to communicate what his life, death, and resurrection meant for them and for their audience. And we read the Gospels well, not when we try desperately to harmonize these accounts in a way that makes our contemporary sensibilities feel better, but when we seek to understand the unique portrait or picture of Jesus that each author is giving us. And that's going to be our focus today. I want to do a brief introduction and a brief discussion of the kind of main point or the portrait that each gospel author is trying to make. And I'll warn you, this is going to be a bit of a generalization. Sorry, I was getting a phone call just then. But if you're interested in more of this, I highly recommend that book by Burridge that I mentioned, Four Gospels, One Jesus. You can find it on Amazon. Anyway, let's start with Mark. We start with Mark because many scholars agree that Mark was the earliest of the four accounts. It was the first one written. Mark is also the shortest of the four Gospels, and it is famous for its furious pace. Jesus does almost no teaching in Mark. There are a few short parables and things like that, but instead, he is mostly depicted as a man of action. Constantly, Jesus is moving, as Mark says, quote, immediately from place to place to place. And the timeline of Jesus's ministry is left very vague. How long he goes about this or anything like that is kind of left up in the air. Not only is Jesus's timeline in Mark a mystery, but his very identity is uncertain throughout most of the account. Rather than blatantly coming out and saying it, for the most part, Mark allows his characters, and therefore us as his readers, to slowly discover the truth and the meaning of Jesus' identity and his significance over time. And it's not like he ties it up in a nice, neat little bow. Even the ending of Mark is pretty ambiguous. As the women encounter the empty tomb, they don't really do anything with the news. And Mark kind of ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. And a lot of scholars believe that's because what the author is doing is he is sort of putting the ball in our court. And we are left to decide what to do, we as readers, with this good news of Jesus's resurrection. So one of many big takeaways from Mark, and one of many things we can focus on when reading his account, when we're reading Mark, learn to lean into the mystery and the challenge to take ownership over our own faith. So if Mark is mysterious, Matthew is almost the exact opposite. While almost 90% of Mark's account also appears in Matthew, nearly word for word, Matthew also expands on Mark and gives us a bit of a fuller portrait of Jesus by including things like a birth story, more resurrection narrative, and a lot more teaching. Matthew sort of subscribes and structures his account a little bit closer to the traditional structure of a Greco-Roman biography that we have been talking about. Matthew is also thought to be the most, quote, Jewish of the gospel accounts, specifically because of how consistently the author seems to connect Jesus with the narrative of Israel. Now, we talked last week about how all the gospel authors are doing this. Yes, they're all using allusions and echoes and hyperlinks and hashtags to the Old Testament in their writing. But Matthew is certainly the most committed to this. Matthew references the Old Testament with quotations 3 times more than Mark does. He begins his entire account with a genealogy walking through the Old Testament, connecting Jesus to King David from the Old Testament. And as we've talked about before, Matthew, he structures his entire account to mirror the 5 books of the Jewish Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Matthew is deeply committed to tying Jesus to the story of Israel because Matthew is writing to a mainly Jewish audience. Of course, then, part of the shock of Matthew's gospel is that this Jesus, who fulfills all the Jewish Old Testament, is rejected by the very Jews he came to save in the end. It is the high priests and the Jews who end up killing him, which is why Matthew's account ends with the resurrected Jesus sending his disciples to the Gentiles to share his good news. This is what we call the Great Commission, to go and preach the good news to all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit. So when reading Matthew, then, watch out for a Jesus who fulfills the Old Testament. Be on guard for how often Matthew is referencing the Old Testament and what that reference, remember what we talked about last week, what that reference to the Old Testament is meant to reveal to us about the character and identity of Jesus. So that's Mark with his ambiguity. We have Matthew with his extreme Jewishness, but then ultimately leading the message to the Gentiles. Then we get to Luke. And speaking of Gentiles, Luke's account, much like Matthew's, is a lot closer in terms of structure to a traditional Greco-Roman biography. Luke has the most birth narrative of anyone else, gives a lot of backstory, almost 3 chapters worth. Luke has a ton of resurrection narrative, and Luke also has plenty of teaching. However, while Matthew seemed heavily focused on the Jews, Luke has another different focus, the poor and the lowly. Luke, after all, is the author who tells us that Jesus' ministry was primarily bankrolled by women, a historically marginalized group, and especially in the first century. We learn in Luke chapter 8 that Jesus' ministry was mostly funded by women. Luke gives us 3 parables of lost things in chapter 15. And he also gives us a shocking parable of a evil, at the time, Samaritan, who acts more godly and righteous than the chosen priests in Luke chapter 10. All of these stories center on different types of outcasts. And, by the way, all of those stories are unique to Luke's account. It is only in Luke's account that we find the parables of the lost things, that we find the parable of the Good Samaritan, or we find all of these stories about these significant women and the role that they played in Jesus' ministry. Burridge, in his book, puts it this way. He says, Luke portrays Jesus as concerned for all those bearing burdens, especially those who have none to share the weight, the poor, outcasts, women, and Gentiles. So when reading Luke, we can watch out for a Jesus who cares deeply for those who have been left out. So these three accounts, Mark, Matthew, and Luke, they all have their unique distinctions, but they are all also very, very similar. They share a lot of the same stories. They share a similar structure. Then we get to the Gospel of John, my favorite gospel for obvious reasons. But John shares very little in terms of word-for-word content with the other three, what we call synoptic gospels. Scholars believe that the Gospel of John was written much later than the other three, and even its style is very, very different. It is much more poetic. It's much more artistic, often inviting the reader into a deeper or more metaphorical understanding of stories. I'll give you an example of this. In John chapter 9, we have a very famous story of Jesus healing a man who was born blind. And on the surface, this is a story of a man who is physically blind being healed by Jesus. But throughout this story, there is this underlying layer of Pharisees and neighbors and even the man's parents who are spiritually blind to the truth of who Jesus is. The irony of the story is that the only person in the story who can truly see and understand the identity of Jesus is the man born blind. And this type of irony or double or multiple layers of meaning is all over John's gospel. Rather than starting with Jesus's birth, John, he goes for broke. He does a full send and goes all the way back to the beginning of creation. And unlike his counterparts, John makes a clear claim from the beginning that not only is Jesus the Messiah of Israel, but Jesus is God himself in the flesh. John chapter 1 opens with this beautifully poetic depiction of Jesus being the Word of God, which has been around since the beginning. The Word was with God, the Word was God, and then eventually you get down to the middle of the poem, and that same Word, who was with God and was God at the beginning, that same Word became flesh. And this claim of Jesus not only being God's Son, but also being God himself, which is often called Christology among theologians, this is definitely something to look out for when reading John's gospel. So, that's what we have. We understand now some of the unique emphases of each gospel author. We understand that with Mark, we have to lean into the mystery and the challenge for us as readers to take ownership over our response to Jesus. With Matthew, we need to make sure to look out for all of these references to the Old Testament and what that reveals about Jesus's identity. With Luke, we see a Jesus who is so committed to serving the poor and the left out. And then with John, we see a Jesus who is not just the Messiah, not just God's Son, but God himself in the flesh. But we still need to answer this question of why. Yes, how does having four unique accounts with four unique perspectives on Jesus help us to understand who he is and obviously follow him more closely? And I think there are two helpful things here as we wrap up. First, having four accounts rather than one, as we said before, gives us a fuller, more complete picture of who Jesus was and the significance of his life. Rather than only knowing about his ministry to the Jews that we learn about in Matthew, we also see the depth of his heart for the lost and for the outsiders in Luke. And we learn in John that it is God himself who cares for all of these people. If we only had one account, we would only know about his heart for the Jews, or we would only know about his heart for the outsiders, or we would only know about his identity as God in the flesh. But because we have all four, we get this more rounded, fuller picture. But at the same time, we also have to acknowledge that it is impossible for any of these accounts to fully encapsulate the full picture of who the real Jesus really was. Remember what Mark said, this Jesus ultimately is a mystery. But what these four accounts do is they provide boundaries for our limited understanding of Jesus to work within. Burridge illustrates this with the picture of a ballpark or a stadium where a game is played. He says this, somewhere in between the four boundaries of the four gospel accounts, somewhere in between the four boundaries, running around on the field of play, but refusing to be tied down, is the historical Jesus whose character stimulated it all in the first place. And at the end of the day, the main point of these accounts and the main point of reading the Gospels is not, as we talked about before, to smooth out all the differences and make sure that all the exact words or facts are straight. No, that's not the point. The point of studying these texts is to try to understand more deeply the character and the heart of Jesus so that we as his followers can imitate him more and more in our lives. And so I hope this has been helpful for your reading. And I hope that you will join us. We talked last week about this 30-day gospel reading challenge that we are on. It's never too late to join. Obviously, you know, we're a week into it already, so you may have to do a little bit of catch up, but over the next month, we are reading through all four gospel accounts together. So you can find the calendar, our reading schedule, in the description to this podcast. Also, if you enjoy this podcast, if these lessons on the Gospels are blessing you and helpful for you, I would really, really appreciate it if you would consider leaving a review on the JohnCast, specifically those of you who are listening on Apple Podcasts. That's really helpful for me to help the show continue to grow and reach more people so that more people can move forward in their faith journey. That's our mission. That's our purpose here. That is all I have for you this week. May you be blessed this week in your gospel reading, and may you come to a deeper understanding of who Jesus is so that you can follow him more closely with your life. I love you all. Keep being awesome.